constantly smiling in front of bereaved families at times when she showed nothing but utter disrespect for everything and everybody in that courtroom today. The fact that she'll never see daylight again in the outside world is of huge comfort for the family.
Stuart Hall has pleaded not guilty to sex attacks on two girls. The 84-year-old former BBC broadcaster has been charged with 15 counts of rape and 5 of indecent assault between 1976 and 1981. He's due to go on trial in May. Police say hundreds of people have lost millions of pounds to an international fraud scam. Officers have made more than 100 arrests in countries including the UK and Spain after fraudsters conned people into spending thousands on fake investments. One woman who's called herself Joan lost £23,000 after a man convinced her to buy non-existent carbon credits over the phone.
I foolishly trusted him and I did borrow money out of my house. I thought, well, even if I can't pay it all back, it will be making such good returns anyway that I will have done other things with that money and will have got profits on whatever I do with them.
1,000 jobs are at risk after women's clothing chain Internationale went into administration. It's got 89 UK stores. In sport, Manchester City manager Manuel Pellegrini has been given an immediate two-match touchline ban by UEFA. It's because of comments that he made about the referee after City's Champions League defeat to Barcelona. And England's cricketers have just got their innings underway in the first one-day international against the West Indies. The host posted a score of 269 for 6 in Antigua. A few moments ago, England were on 6 without loss. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2.
Their goal is revenge for the persecution of men of intellect and science throughout the Middle and Dark Ages by the church, by the kings and queens, by the governments, and by the ignorant mob. That's why they want to destroy all existing governments, destroy all existing religions, and put the shackles on the mob.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. First, Egypt, where the elected president faces a death sentence. Now, Kiev and Ukraine, where Yanukovych is a wanted man. Who was it that overturned democracy in Ukraine? Was it pro-NATO armed gangs? And will Russian President Vladimir Putin be taking it lying down? The battle for Ukraine began in earnest last Friday when the Kiev Parliament building was occupied by armed men. The ruling party of the regions, the MPs, were shot at and forced out, leaving a rump of right-wing pro-EU MPs who then voted to impeach President Yanukovych. Now, Russian troops are carrying out scheduled exercises on the Ukrainian border, and other groups of militias and armed men are popping up all over Ukraine. Martin Summers will take us to Ukraine on his weekly tour of Global Flashpoints in a minute. And also, food additives, one very good reason to check the label tonight, as we look at a sweetener neurosurgeons call a poison that's in much of our food, called aspartame. And the media, as a media battle rages to explain the inexcusable, that's to mark the anniversary of the First World War outbreak, Martin Summers will take us through former BBC Newsnight economics editor Paul Mason's four-part series that could not, in his opinion, that's Paul Mason's opinion, be produced in Britain today. The People's First World War. Tonight we look at part two, The Slaughter. And it's the 20th anniversary this week of the death of the Texas-born comedian Bill Hicks. Some believe he was bumped off just as he was about to get his own network TV show over in the US, and we celebrate his memory by hearing why he might have been such a danger to the US establishment. But we start this week with Ukraine, Martin, and last Friday was quite an important day, wasn't it?
Well, yes, the situation obviously is developing as we speak. The real danger, of course, is that you're now, in a pre-war situation, a la, the Slovenian revolt against Yugoslavia in 1991.
Just tell us what happened there and how it compares, then.
Well, it's the same. When you've got a situation where people are not resolving a political crisis through political means, but are using military force, then you're on a slippery slope.
Yeah, but Yanukovych, although he was democratically elected, he wasn't popular, was he? With massive demonstrations in the streets.
Yes, but of course his main support isn't in Kiev in the West Ukraine, it's in the East Ukraine in the Donbass, where he's from, and in Crimea. So in other words, it's like if people of London besieged Parliament and demanded something, but in actual fact the rest of the country doesn't really support them, which was a common problem in the French Revolution, for example. The crowds in Paris were very revolutionary and wanted to kill the king, etc., but the peasants out there in the country were not so sure. And in general, the Western policy in general used to be that, you know, elections are elections and protests are protests, but protesters can't demand that the government go.
We keep hearing on the news here about the impeachment of Yanukovych. He's a wanted man. But these resolutions have been passed through a parliament where the ruling party has actually been removed from their seats.
Well, I'm not quite sure of the detail of this, but I think it is quite insignificant that it's a bit like the beginning of the English Civil War, isn't it, where the royalist members of parliament withdrew from the parliament or were kicked out, and a new junta took over representing the parliamentary forces. But the real problem in Ukraine is that you've got a split between the Ukraine as a country has only made the shape it was now in 1954, because I just read recently that the Crimea, for example, was not historically part of Ukraine and was put into the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic in 1954. And in any case, the Ukraine itself was only created as a state in 1945 by large chunks of what had previously been Poland being included in it. So in other words, when you talk about a country and whether people are represented, the government's representative, the question is, does that country exist? And, you know, like, does the UK exist? And as some people will be saying, down with Ukrainia, and some people will be saying, down with Ukrainia. And we have similar problems in this country, don't we?
Well,
Northern Ireland, Scotland, etc.
A lot of the problems seem to start last week, Wednesday and Thursday, when scores of both police and demonstrators were killed as guns managed to find their way into what had up until then been a relatively peaceful protest. At least certainly there weren't armed gangs hanging around. And on Friday morning last week, on BBC Radio 5 Live, there's quite an interesting reporter by the name of Marco Boyson. So let's have a listen to what Marco Boyson then had to say about the sniper rifles which were being used to kill demonstrators in the streets of Kiev.
There was a report yesterday in the most reputable Kiev newspaper, Zerkalo Nedeli, that the snipers who are shooting at the demonstrators with high-velocity rifles are using rifles that were manufactured in Britain. And I can't verify that report, but I think it's incumbent on the British government to find out whether there are rifles being exported to the Secret Service of Ukraine from Britain that are being used against the protesters.
Thank you both. Marco Boyson, who is a Ukraine expert at New York University in London.
Victoria Derbyshire there from the BBC, just ending that report from Marco Boyson from New York University in London. Martin, is this normal for Britain to be exporting these sniper rifles? We're told they were AVK type sniper rifles, which were then used to kill demonstrators.
It's very normal. I mean, Britain basically is one of the biggest arms exporters in the world, and as long as the government is a legitimate government, which the Yanukovych government was until the day before yesterday, then of course they can buy weaponry from Britain for their security forces, and we will happily sell it to them. The real question in my mind is who armed the demonstrators and where did they get their weapons and possibly weapons training from, and were Western intelligence services in any way involved in that, directly or indirectly, as they have been in Syria? Because it could well be that Britain is arming terrorists around the world. Oh, did I say that? Well, we've been doing it for years, so why are we surprised? And I'm not just talking about over-the-counter sales to police forces.
What about these militias that are now popping up right across? I mean, effectively, the demonstrators in Kiev city centre formed themselves into a militia of some sort to take over the parliament building Friday night. So these militias exist. I mean, they're popping up now. Over in Sevastopol and other places.
Yeah.
Where is this likely to lead? Because no one is admitting who's actually controlling these. Who might be controlling them?
Well, I mean, the different militias will have different strings being pulled by different people. But the real danger, as I pointed out in my book, which came out in 1998, was that Ukraine becomes the new Yugoslavia.
Just remind us of the title of that book, Mark.
The book's called Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle, and it was co-authored by myself, Martin Summers, and Laszlo Andor, who's a Hungarian, who is currently a European Commissioner for Growth and Jobs. Incidentally, the Hungarian government is supporting the Russian government on this, which is rather unusual.
Okay. Why did you make that comparison then between the Balkans and the possibly what may be happening now in Ukraine?
What happened in Yugoslavia, which was one country, but of course, is it one country? Is it five countries? Is it seven countries? It's a real question. There were massive differences culturally and economically in Yugoslavia. So you had some very poor parts of the country, mainly in the south, particularly Kosovo, and in Slovenia at the other end was a relatively prosperous place, not dissimilar to Austria over the border. And trying to keep all of these different ethnic communities and with different levels of economic development in one structure was very difficult. And you've got similar tension in the Ukraine, because the IMF have now arrived in Kiev, and they're going to give a credit to the new government, but they have to carry out reforms. Now, what those reforms mean is that everybody who works in heavy industry in the Donbass is going to have to be kicked out of their jobs, and it's all going to have to be privatised. They're not going to like that, and the way to avoid that, from their point of view, is to declare independence from Kiev, because don't forget that this country, Ukraine, was only created by Stalin in 1945. It's got no real basis. And that's why, if you push and say, well, we're going to force our way and have our people running Ukraine, whichever side it is, Russian or European side, the other side aren't going to be happy, and the potential for a civil war grows up. Simply, where do you draw the line? You could say, well, let's just have two countries, you know? But the problem is, where do you draw the line? And it's a bit like drawing the line of the six counties in Northern Ireland. Where do you draw the line? Through the middle of this farm? Down this road? It's not quite clear. And of course the militias, as in Yugoslavia, will fight to determine where that line is. And that's the danger.
Now, we've already heard that there are Russian troops massing on the border, doing some sort of apparently pre-scheduled exercise, if you believe that, on the eastern borders of Ukraine. Now, I mean, are we looking at a scenario here where the Russians will be bringing their own troops up to the eastern border of Ukraine, the NATO forces bringing their troops up to the western borders of Ukraine, and then fighting it out within using sponsored militias from both sides? Is that
pretty? Yeah, that's pretty much what happened in Bosnia.
And possibly looking at the individual regional administration buildings as a kind of key place to take over.
Yeah, well, the far-right Svoboda Party seized the administration building in Lviv in the west of Ukraine and declared independence of Kiev. But, of course, the counter-manoeuvre to that is the people in the east Ukraine declaring independence from Kiev in their turn. And you could say, well, let's just have a divorce, like Scotland and England might have a divorce. But the problem is there's no agreed border between these two communities. So who's going to get what?
No, we're hearing today, this is BBC News, just less than an hour ago, the ex-leader Viktor Yanukovych is vowing to fight back. He's given a press conference today in Russia, saying that he was not overthrown, but was compelled to leave Ukraine under threats to his life. I mean, that Victoria Derbyshire programme we heard there confirmed that they were chanting death to Yanukovych. There were people there saying that on that particular programme. And the latest flare-up, according to the BBC, Ukraine has accused Russian troops of seizing two airports in the Crimea. These charges have been denied by Moscow, and Russian President Vladimir Putin's called for a rapid return to normality.
Well, what really complicates the situation in the Crimea is that the Crimea was only placed as part of the Ukraine by Brezhnev in 1954. And the original inhabitants of the Ukraine were Crimean Tatars, in other words, of Muslim origin. They'd conquered it, you know, centuries previously. And they were all deported by Stalin in the 40s for collaborating, supposedly, with the Germans. And then they only came back at the end of the war. So they are pro-Ukrainian. In other words, they're pro-Kiev. Whereas the majority of the population, about 60%, are Russian-speaking and are pro-Moscow. And, of course, the Crimea in particular is the flashpoint because, A, it wasn't in the Ukraine in the first place. It's only put in the Ukraine by the Soviet government. And, secondly, this is where the Russians have got their Black Sea fleet, which is the people that faced the West off and in the Eastern Mediterranean over Syria earlier last year. And so from the Russian point of view, that's an absolutely crucial geopolitical pawn that they can't afford to lose. So the potential for conflict here, as happened in Yugoslavia between two different coalitions of forces, is definitely there.
I intend to continue to struggle for the future of Ukraine against terror and fear, Mr. Yanukovych said today in the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don. What's going on now is lawlessness, lack of authority and terror. Decisions in parliament were taken under duress. He apologised to the Ukrainian people for not having enough strength to keep stability and described his usurpers as young neo-fascists. Now, I noticed that Seamus Milne a few weeks ago in The Guardian was saying that actually there's quite a strong far-right fascist element to what was the demonstrators in Kiev, now presumably in charge.
Well, there are also more moderate demonstrators, so let's try and keep a sense of balance. But yes, there are right-wing forces in the Ukraine who openly celebrate the support of Ukrainian nationalists for the Germans in the 1940s. And, of course, that's red rag to a Russian bull. So the potential for a lot of antagonism here is very high. And, of course, the Crimean Tatars were also accused of being pro-German, whether that was true or not. So you've got, just as in Yugoslavia, you've got all those dead ghosts of probably, if you think about the Ukraine, that probably was the battleground of World War II. Probably more people died in Ukraine. It was more awful as the German army surges across the Ukraine and then were driven back through it with the ordinary people just caught up in it. That was the nub of World War II, the worst bit of it. So all of that history is there to be resurrected if people are stupid enough to do so.
Well, I mean, it was particularly bad, wasn't it? But for Russian prisoners of war, I mean, the Nazis really did not look after them at all. I think I'm right in saying something like 3.5 million Russian prisoners of war were starved to death or tortured to death, etc. They weren't kept in prison camps and fed, that sort of thing.
No, I mean, the point is that this ought to be resolved politically. I don't know if it will be, because it's become a zero-sum game between the West and the East. And in actual fact, the danger of a conflict here with people, I mean, people have already died, but a lot more people dying is definitely there. I mean, what will happen is what happened in Bosnia, is that certain parts of the country will be controlled by Western forces and certain parts will be controlled by Eastern forces, and there will be a front line. And if the hatred is enough, then they'll start massacring civilians as they did in Bosnia.
But it seems to me there's a bit of game playing going on here. Both sides, the Russians and NATO, both pretending that events have been spontaneous, when actually there's been actually quite a lot of geostrategic influence going on.
It would be difficult to make all of these political things line up in Ukraine, but in actual fact they've done quite a good job. In my book in 1998, I predicted exactly this kind of crisis, and I expected it to come quite quickly. So in a way, I'm amazed that it's taken 16 years for it to happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because Ukrainians found a fantastic skill for compromise. They really did just bumble along and manage to hold it all together, largely because they didn't bring in the IMF, they didn't go in for shock therapy. They knew it would cause. You see, a lot of underlying all of this is the economic failure of the Ukraine. Its post-Soviet history has been disastrous. A small minority of oligarchs have taken all of the wealth of the collective wealth of the country, and everybody else has been left with nothing, which then leads them to be very receptive to whatever nutcase is screaming in their ear.
In other developments, this BBC report is saying Swiss and Austrian authorities have blocked the assets of Viktor Yanukovych and his associates and launched a corruption probe. Russian MPs have proposed new laws that would make it easier for Russia to incorporate parts of Ukraine. And amid fears of hyperinflation, you mentioned this earlier, Martin, yeah, Ukraine's central bank has put a 1,000 euro, it's the Ukrainian currency is a hryvnia, Hryvnia, which I find almost impossible to pronounce. So we'll call it 1,000 euros or £820 limit on daily cash withdrawals. And the UN Security Council is set to hold a private discussions on the crisis today.
Yes, well, I mean, the underlying economic crisis in Ukraine is partly to do with the political crisis, but also to do with the quantitative easing taper in the US, the emerging markets. And it's not just Ukraine. You've got Venezuela, Thailand, Argentina, Turkey, all of these countries are going into political crisis. And you're getting a situation where you've got democracy on paper, but the divisions within countries are so great that people can't accept losing an election.
Well, I remember
on Thursday last week,
Yanukovych agreed to a May election, which I mean, he was originally saying it was going to be the end of this year, December election. Yeah. Then he was negotiated down to say there's going to be a general election in Ukraine in May. The next thing we hear, Parliament's been stormed, democracy is gone, surely.
That's why the Russians are annoyed, because from their point of view, they're saying, look, they were pushing Yanukovych to call the opposition to join the government. Let's form a government of national unity. Basically what we've done in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Although that's been somewhat in question this week. But if one lot say, well, we're not having that, we want all or nothing, then it creates a situation where the other side are going to say, right, it's all or nothing then. And at that point, there isn't an agreement to agree about having a democracy or having a country called Ukraine at all, is there?
What about the geography? Because if you look at the maps of that area, you've got a kind of Ukraine sort of pokes away from Russia into some of these former Soviet countries, which are in Eastern Europe. What about the geography of it? Because we've got this whole area, the Russian Black Sea Fleet and the Crimea involved here as well.
Yeah. Well, as I say, the Crimea only became part of the Ukraine in 1954. So they've got a very strong case of the people down there saying, well, actually, we're part of Russia. But, of course, that's not accepted by the Tatar minority in the Ukraine. They want to stay part of the Crimea. They are pro-Kiev. So the potential, for example, for Russian and Tatar conflict inside the Ukraine is very definitely there. Can anybody hear Kosovo here? Can anybody hear Bosnia? These possibilities exist. And the thing about the Ukraine is it's still got nuclear weapons. This isn't like a Balkan country. And the Western powers and Russia will be drawn in to support their protégés if this is what happens. And, of course, this is all taking place in the middle of a global economic crisis. So it won't just be the Ukraine where people will be killing each other. They're killing each other in Thailand, but we haven't been told about that on our TVs. That's a long way, a faraway country of which we know little. But similar conflicts are emerging all over the world. And, of course, in Egypt, the Western-backed military dictatorship is busily killing the Muslim Brotherhood supporters who won the election. So it depends who wins the election, whether we support them or not, doesn't it?
Going back to the geography, I mean, you've got the Black Sea there, you've got Turkey below the Black Sea, you've got Ukraine above it. Really, the eastern half or two-thirds of Ukraine pokes straight into Russia, Martin, doesn't it? And actually, Kiev itself is not very far from Moscow.
No, I mean, it's a much further on that than it looks on your map there. Well, the point is that from the Russian point of view, think about Syria. They were able to play a very hardball game over Syria last year because they got the Black Sea Fleet was able to project Russian power into the Eastern Mediterranean, including sending their aircraft carrier missile destroyer, which was probably the game changer in terms of forcing the West to back off. But, of course, if this could be seen as the West's punishment to Putin for that, we are now going to provoke problems right in your face in Ukraine because we were so fed up with the way he frustrated us over Syria. And of course this directly impacts upon Putin's capacity to intervene in Syria, because if the Ukraine keeps control of Crimea, they could decide to kick out the Black Sea Fleet and so on.
All the key things that happened to do with the takeover of the parliament in Kiev happened just as the Sochi Olympic Games were closing. I'm reminded of a few years ago, the Beijing Olympics, when the opening ceremony of that was used as an excuse at the time, while all the world's media were looking over at China, for there to be attacks in South Ossetia, South Ossetia, yeah, and Georgia. So, I mean, am I stretching a point to think that there may
you can
timing?
Imagine that the Russian general staff are thinking of it in these terms. Is this all spontaneous, or is it actually being orchestrated by Western intelligence services?
Martin, 500 miles roughly it is between Kiev and Moscow. Now, that's not a long way in terms of this now being a centre for NATO.
Yes, but don't forget that Kiev was the original basis of the Russian state. Moscow only became the capital of Russia long after Kiev. So there's a very strong kind of emotional commitment to keeping Kiev in Russia, very similar to the Serbian belief that Kosovo belonged to them because it used to belong to them, and their famous battle of Kosovopoli against the Turks where they were defeated was there. But of course in modern times, Kosovo became a majority Muslim area. But of course if we start talking about which parts of Ukraine have got majorities of what, then we're already on the slippery slope to Bosnia on steroids.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour that the democratically elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was overthrown, has been jailed, and is now facing a death sentence. We also now have the situation with Yanukovych. I mean, he managed to scoot out of the country. He's over in Russia now. But certainly, you know, he is going to be arrested if he's back in the western part of Ukraine. There's also another connection, isn't there, between these two conflicts? I mean, both democratically elected leaders, both overthrown, both criminalised by the new regime. And there is another connection, and that is that there was an article on the Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, which showed two leaflets which were distributed in the last couple of weeks. One leaflet was in the last couple of weeks in Kiev, which was identical, although it had Ukrainian script on it, Ukrainian writing, identical to another leaflet which was distributed in Egypt a couple of years ago, or actually, no, last year, beginning of last year, when Morsi was overthrown. So, I mean, is this really just a bit of photocopying job going on here? Or do you think that there's actually some sort of deliberate program behind the scenes to overthrow these democratic governments?
Well, there's a deliberate program to overthrow governments which don't do what the West wants, democratic or otherwise. And a key player in all of this is an organization called Canvas, CANVAS, that used to be called Otpor. And they are based in Belgrade. And they are basically,
okay, CANVAS stands for the Centre for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies.
Yeah, and they originally, they grew out of Otpor. Otpor are very definitely funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and other US government agencies. And what the Western intelligence services have been developing over the last few years is what I call their 1968 department. So they overthrow governments by getting students into the street, getting them beaten up by the police, getting the police to overreact, and then you can push governments out. So Milosevic was pushed out by that kind of tactic in Serbia, and similarly with Morsi in Egypt. Now, of course, the Russians are not entirely innocent of this. They support their protégés as well. But, of course, the danger with everybody supporting their protégés in these very, very 50-50 situations is that democracy as a whole is undermined. If people can see that the only way to get your way, whatever side you're on, is to get into the street, start demonstrating, and if necessary, kill policemen, because there's no doubt about it, the demonstrators in Kiev did kill policemen, whether that's okay or not. I mean, you might say it's justified, you might not, but it certainly happened. If you compare this with what went on in Northern Ireland for many years, is that there was an understanding on both sides that after Bloody Sunday, that live ammunition was not to be used in street confrontations. So you'd often get fights and struggles and Molotov cocktails and rubber bullets being used, but neither side would bring firearms to the table. But of course, what's happened in Kiev, what it seems, we'll have to go back over it. It looks as if the demonstrators open fire on the police then retaliate, and this is all part of the Otpor playbook. Yeah,
but this is
very similar to what happened in Syria, where what were essentially peaceful demonstrations collapse into chaos, and then of course you've got an armed rebellion on.
So how is the National Endowment for Democracy, how can something, an organisation that's promoting democracy, be involved in something which is so anti-democratic as to overthrow a democratically elected president who was only elected about a year ago,
and also
was agreeing to more democratic elections in the very near future?
Well, what the problem from a Russian point of view is this is, you arrogate to yourselves in the West the right to promote democracy at government expense, so British taxpayer money will be spent on helping demonstrators in countries like Ukraine and Syria. But if the Russians, for example, were to pay activists in Britain to go round stirring things up, the British might be not very happy about it. But the West goes around basically supposedly spreading democracy, but basically pushing their agenda at taxpayer expense in other people's countries. And, you know, inevitably the Russians take a dim view of it. From their point of view, this is a vital national interest for us, and we can't afford to let you push us around. I hope they're not going to overreact. The most sensible thing for them to do is just to try and take the heat out of the situation. And, of course, they do have leverage over Ukraine, because Ukraine owes Russia a load of money. So the Russians could just say, well, either pay us your money now, or we will cut off your gas supply. And, you know, but of course, if they cut off the gas supply to the Ukraine, that means that the gas supply to Western Europe is cut off. So Western Europe is dependent on Russian gas. So the Russians could start to play hardball here and say, right, well, we're not going to sell our gas to you at less than world market prices. I mean, this is a lot of what this was about, is that they were saying to the Ukraine, well, if you want to do things we don't like, because you're our friends and neighbours, we're prepared to sell you your gas at way below the market price. But if you're going to be a nuisance and make trouble for us, then you must pay us the market price, which you can't afford, so we're just going to switch off your gas supply. But of course, from the Russian point of view, that's a bit problematic, because it means cutting off their German customers who pay perfectly well, and they're not that keen to do that. So hopefully, because all these interests are involved, everybody will get sensible and negotiate. But the potential for this to go the wrong way is very definitely there. And it seems to me that many Western politicians, like John McCain, who was over there encouraging the far-right demonstrators to have a go at the police, they are playing with fire. Because ultimately this could blow up and we'll all be the losers.
Martin, there is another dimension to this, which is the religious dimension. Jewish synagogues and Eastern Orthodox Christian churches have been and are being attacked now in the West.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians, as I say, the Ukrainian far right were in alliance with the Nazis. So, for example, it was the Ukrainian SS that finished off the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, the Warsaw Uprising in Poland. So you can see that for many Russians, they see the Ukrainian nationalists as extremely problematic, because they've got a track record of being pro-Nazi. Now, that's not to say that all Ukrainian nationalists are pro-Nazi, that's an exaggeration, but there is very definitely a far-right extremist element involved in the Ukraine, a bit like the sort of Ulster Defence Association or the Ulster Volunteer Force, for example.
Okay, you mentioned Ireland there, and there's been quite a lot of discussion about that this week too. So we'll leave Ukraine for the time being and move to Ireland. What about the Hyde Park bombings in the 1980s and this chap Duffy, who's been now told there will be no prosecution? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as Martin McGuinness said yesterday, I don't know anybody's surprised about this. Surely everybody knew that a deal had been done, that the peace process was going to be... I mean, it was basically linked to the IRA's weapons handover. They agreed to hand over their weapons on the understanding, A, that their prisoners would be released, and B, that those who were on the run would be basically allowed to go. And that was part of the deal. And the leadership of Sinn Féin sold the deal to the IRA foot soldiers, if you like, on the basis that what they were going to get out of it was that they could then go, you know, they could go back to living in peace as civilians. And this chap that was going to be prosecuted is reputedly a very strong supporter of the peace process. And that's, of course, if you want people like that to support the peace process, there's a quid pro quo.
So why was he arrested then?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because I think there was some file left over, or some warrant that hadn't been cleared up. But what really fascinates me about this is that he was arrested the same day as Woolwich, and it turns out that he's going to be they agreed not to prosecute him the same day as the Woolwich bombers, the Woolwich murderers, whatever
Lee
they
Rigby's
are,
word,
the Rigby, Lee Rigby's murderers were put on trial. So there's an obvious kind of disjunction going on here. I mean, the IRA chap killed four British soldiers, and he's not going to be prosecuted.
Well, we don't know it was him for a start.
Well, no, we don't. We don't. That's fair
Nobody
enough.
Knows.
But I mean, the point is, what I wonder is the timing here. The timing here, because why are these two cases, which have got nothing to do with each other, over many decades apart, why is it that the same day as Woolwich this chap is arrested, and the same day as it's agreed that he's not going to be prosecuted, the Woolwich two are sentenced? Now, I don't, it's just curious, it may just be coincidence, but I, you know, you've got to remember that the way I'm thinking, well, which intelligence services is pulling the strings here, and what kind of effect are they hoping to create? And that would be as true of what goes on in Ireland as it is of what goes on in Ukraine or Syria. Things are not what they seem. That doesn't mean I know what's happening. I don't. But don't presume you know either.
Now, what possible motive could there be for connecting the two? One is a so-called IRA terrorist suspect. The others are now convicted Islamists. Terrorists, murderers.
Yes, but at the same time, it was also killing of British soldiers in London. Well, I mean, the fact is, the question is, what element of false flag may or may not be going on here? Now, I'm not accusing. I've thought quite deeply about what went on at Woolwich. They definitely did have contact with the security services, so there is a question mark over who these chaps are and how they ended up where they are. I mean, somebody put them up to what they did. The question is, who put them up to what they did? And if you look at the Boston bombing in the US, I think it's absolutely clear that the Tsarnaev brothers, who have been blamed for it, are basically were working with the intelligence services and were set up as patsies. Now, this could be the case with our two converts from Nigeria, who were not born Muslims but ended up in a crazy situation doing crazy things because somebody had been feeding them a load of nonsense. The question is, who? Because we know for a fact that Western intelligence services do run Islamic terrorist groups. They're running them in Syria right now, as the Syrian government will tell you.
Now, the finger of blame has been pointed at the police service of Northern Ireland in the John Downey case, and we hear that there's going to be a judge-led inquiry into the IRA amnesty, they call it in inverted commas, in the Metro today, as the Hyde Park bombing suspect trial came to an end. So do you think this is going to put an end to it? A judge-led inquiry into how these letters were sent out to people who there are questions about whether they should have been sent to?
Well, as I said earlier, Martin McGuinness was saying that, you know, you knew that a deal had been done, and various loyalist politicians saying, but we didn't know they were going to send them letters. And they said, well, you didn't need to know. But the point is, yes, there were letters sent, but, you know, why is everybody getting excited about this? This has been on the... people have known that this is what the reality is for a long time. What Sinn Féin have been calling for all along is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where everybody comes forward and tells what they really did, including Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who used to run the Force Research Unit, responsible for directing the Loyalist Terror Campaign. Or the people who bombed Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, who the Irish police are pretty much convinced were British intelligence agents. Now, they must be living in retirement somewhere. Perhaps we should put everybody on trial, including perhaps Margaret Thatcher, although she's dead, because she may have given permission for various illegal activities when she was Prime Minister. If we really want to go back over it, let's go back over it. But it'll cut two ways, you can be sure of that.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now on to our story to do with food additives. One very good reason to check the label tonight as we look at the sweetener that neurosurgeons call a poison. That's in much of our food. It's called aspartame. And we're going to go now and have a look at a little excerpt from a documentary called Sweet Misery. It's called Sweet Misery in a Poisoned World. And we'll hear from various doctors. And at the end, the main talk is from Dr. Russell Blaylock, who's a neurosurgeon. This documentary was broadcast, I don't know if it's ever been broadcast, it certainly was put online back nearly 10 years ago.
Now, the amino acids are contained in, but if you have protein, meat, fish, and so forth, there may be 4% phenylalanine in the food, but not 50%. And we simply, biologically, don't know how to react to this flooding of these enormous amounts of amino acids in the body, especially the phenylalanine, which crosses the blood-brain barrier. It's meant to protect against, biologically, against poisons and so forth.
It's also what's called a dipeptide. That is, it is two amino acids stuck together. One of those amino acids is something called phenylalanine. Phenylalanine is the building block for another important neurotransmitter called norepinephrine. So when you take in aspartame, you will increase the availability of one and you'll decrease the availability of the other. You'll change ratios. And when you do that, when you change ratios of norepinephrine and serotonin, you certainly affect brain function. And this can lead then to mood symptoms, to panic symptoms in some people. It'll affect seizure threshold, which is why I think I saw the seizure in this initial patient back in 1985, and why I saw a lot of seizure activity in people who were taking in a great deal of aspartame.
They knew that this product, aspartame, with time breaks down into a product called diketopeperazine. Diketopeperazine chemically is closely related to a carcinogenic compound that causes cancer in a lot of animals that they're exposed to it, and humans. So they asked the GD Serol Company to do a separate study with the diketopeperazine. Well, when they looked at this study, they found some shenanigans as well. And one of the things is when you mix up the diketopeperazine with the animal's food, you have to homogenize it so that it's evenly distributed and the animal can't see it and avoid it. Well, I've seen pictures of the feed, and they left it in big clumps so the rats were eating around it, not actually eating the diketopeperazine. There was also evidence that they were giving the diketopeperazine to the control animals. And, of course, this came up because in the original study, they found a 47-fold increase in brain tumors. In their diketopeperazine repeat study, they said, oh, well, look, the control animals and the aspartame-fed animals had the same incidence of brain tumors. Well, when the neuropathologist looked at it, they said, well, that's kind of strange because now your control animals have a very high incidence of brain tumors that's not naturally found in these mice. And then when they looked at the feed, they found out there were some mix-ups of the feed so that the diketopeperazine was being fed to the control animals. These are the sort of things that's in the Bressler report that the makers of NutraSweet would not like the public to know about because it's very frightening. You know, when the pathologist, Dr. Adrian Gross, looked at the material as well, very well-regarded pathologist, and he looked at it and he was absolutely shocked. He said it's just an enormous increase in tumors, particularly the brain tumors. And, of course, that's exactly what we're seeing now is this tremendous increase in brain tumors in this country, which is completely unexplained by the neurological profession.
That's an extract from the 2004 film Aspartame, Sweet Misery in a Poisoned World. Now, Martin, how can we get to the situation where companies that are producing this stuff are able to lobby for it to go into our food chain? I mean, there certainly are lots of experts that believe that this is actually carcinogenic. And what happens is aspartame breaks down into various products, including something called phenylalanine, which is known to be actually carcinogenic. So could you just explain how these food companies are able to lobby to allow this stuff into the food chain?
Well, it's what's called in the textbooks regulatory capture. The Food Standards Agency is supposed to keep an eye on all of this and make sure that stuff isn't put into the food chain, which is harmful. But money talks, and it talks loudly. And eventually, those who are pushing this stuff are able to get round whatever regulations and controls have been put in place to prevent it.
Now, there's all sorts of products that this is in. I mean, usually what you tend to get is say for example with Coke, you'll get a normal Coke which has just got sugar in, and some sort of diet Coke which has got aspartame in it. Mm-hmm. I personally wouldn't go anywhere near the diet versions of these, but they are marketed as a slimming product.
Well, that is why there was a lot of pressure for this stuff to be allowed into the food chain, because it had a fantastic marketing. This is sugar that isn't sugar, sugar that doesn't make you fat, you know, and that was very attractive to the companies. And, you know, things like Diet Coke and so on depend totally on aspartame.
One for example, I remember seeing the very few documentaries have been on British TV about this, but one I did see was where was a woman who was a jogger, and she was found over a period of months that she was really actually getting quite ill, having all sorts of problems of focusing her eyes and attention on things, and eventually it came out that she'd been chewing gum which has got aspartame in, but while she was jogging she had quite a lot of chewing gum, and so I suppose in small quantities you might not notice it, but in large quantities this is actually incredible that this kind of stuff is allowed into our food chain, isn't it?
It is, but you've got to remember that companies which produce this stuff are very powerful. Just as, you know, the world we live in is run by corporations who have a great deal of power to get what they want, and far more power than they ought to have, frankly.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, the First World War, the struggle is on for interpretation of it. And one documentary that you're very unlikely to see is one suggested by the former economics correspondent for Newsnight, Paul Mason, who now works for Channel 4 News. And he's done a four-part sort of sketch of what a really interesting People's First World War documentary might look like. Martin, we did the causes last week. This week, the slaughter. First of all, the Western Front, trench life until April 1915 and the use of chlorine gas by the Germans.
Well, at this stage of the game, don't forget, but both general staffs on both sides thought that it was going to be a war of movement, very similar to the Napoleonic Wars. It was all going to be over by Christmas, and of course it all bogged down in trench warfare.
Hang on a minute. Whenever a war starts, even with Afghanistan or Iraq, we're told the same thing.
Well, yes, I mean, that is true, but it was particularly not the case in this particular case. And nobody had expected trench warfare. I don't know why, because if they'd looked at the American Civil War, you know, decades before, that's how that had ended, because, you know, the war of movement was over. The defensive was far stronger than the offensive. The use of machine guns in particular meant that the old-style human wave attacks were hopeless, but the general staffs on both sides were committed to that way of doing things, so the whole thing became basically a meat grinder. And of course what you were also including in this period would be the 1914 spontaneous truce between the fighters in the trenches on both sides, saying, well, this is silly, let's celebrate Christmas, which of course is very poignant in the circumstances and has been remembered. And of course chlorine gas used by the Germans was an attempt to break the stalemate of trench warfare. But the problem with chlorine gas is the wind's got to be in the right direction, otherwise it blows in your face and you're the ones who end up dead.
And what about the use of gas? Was that the first time it had been used in conflict? Because obviously, particularly when you've got trench warfare, a lot of people in a small, confined space, this could be a horrific toll on the soldiers on both sides.
In theory, yes, and it was very dangerous. I mean, it did have a horrific toll on the soldiers on both sides, but the problem with it, from a military point of view, that they're almost as likely to do in your own people as the other side, which is one of the reasons why it's not very likely that the Syrian army has been using chemical weapons in Syria, because it doesn't actually work very well at targeting the people you want to kill.
What about the effects of the use of these gases then?
Well, obviously, that was a part of the horror of the situation, because, I mean, my Uncle George was gassed, and he was never the same afterwards. His lungs were ruined, people were blinded. You know, the idea of war as some kind of game with everybody dressed up in silly uniforms and galloping around on horses, that really came to an end when you see people choking and dying on chlorine gas, and some of the best First World War poetry brings out the gas attacks. So the Wilfred Owen poem with it in very much reminds us of the era.
Okay, then the naval warfare and blockades.
Well, this again was. I mean, there had been a naval warfare, a blockade of the continent during the Napoleonic Wars by the Royal Navy. And of course, the purpose of this eventually is to try and starve the German population into submission. There's no doubt about it. And ultimately, it was successful. What won the war for the Western powers was the naval blockade, which led to a situation where the Germans simply couldn't feed their people and had to throw in the towel. So from the German point of view, when they go for U-boat attacks on shipping in the Atlantic, they are trying to break what they regard as a stranglehold around their necks. So again, this is all very, very serious, because the civilian populations on both sides are basically being targeted through the naval blockade and through the U-boat campaign.
Okay, the Somme in 1916.
Well, that's gone down in British history as one of the worst days of the British Army and for the country and so on. But, of course, each country has got its own day of infamy from the First World War. This was Britain's. For the French, it was Verdun. And also for the Germans, Verdun, probably. But, I mean, again, you just had generals who are going for human wave attacks against modern artillery machine guns, and it was never going to work.
Yes, something like a million men were wounded or killed in that battle. Would you think probably that was one of the biggest battles the world had ever seen at that time, the biggest slaughter?
More British soldiers were wounded and killed that day than in the whole previous hundreds of years of its history.
Gallipoli, what was that?
Well, this was an attempt largely pushed by Churchill because of the stalemate on the Western Front. He wanted to try other ways round. So the idea was to attack Turkey, because Turkey was allied with Germany, knock Turkey out of the war as a way of, instead of doing human wave attacks on the Western Front, we're going to try something else. And, of course, it's very hard to explain to young people today why is Australia invading Turkey. And, of course, that's what world wars do. Whatever we thought it was about in the first place, Belgium or Bosnia or whatever, it ends up with a situation where people from Adelaide and Melbourne are storming ashore in Turkey and the Turks are shooting at them, as well they might, since it is Turkey and not Australia.
So, basically, Churchill was behind this idea to attack Constantinople, what's now Istanbul.
Yes, and it was a bit of a disaster. It didn't work. And, of course, in Turkey, the Gallipoli is remembered as a great victory, rather than, wasn't this a terrible
thing?
It's part of the Turkish national identity that their country was invaded by foreigners and they saw them off, as far as they see it. It's their 1940.
And so did it bring the Ottoman Empire, which I suppose was actually destined to be gotten rid of at the end of the First World War, did it bring the Ottomans into the war?
They were already in the war. That's why they were being attacked. They decided to go with the Germans because the British and the French wanted to carve up their empire. So logically enough, their enemy's enemy was their friend, and they sided with the Germans because they saw the British and the French as predators in relationship to their empire.
Okay, finally then, the Brusilov Offensive, a prelude to revolutions.
Well, what you got there is the Russians fell apart. They tried to. They had been beaten at Tannenberg earlier in the war, and the Brusilov offensive was an attempt to try and get back on the front foot. And the Germans thrashed them. And at that point, the morale of the Russian army collapsed. And people forget this, that the Russians were on our side in World War One, and then as they were in World War Two, in fact. And in actual fact, the Germans saw the Russians, ordinary people in Germany saw the Russians as a sort of dictatorship run by the Tsar, and they were quite happy to see them beaten. And of course, ultimately, it led to a revolution inside Russia. And of course, Russia was our ally, so that was all bad for Britain, if you like. But the Germans saw that as a good thing, because the Russians are now out of the war.
Okay, that's all for this week. The second part next week, the revolutions, and just some recommended things to watch to do with First World War. There's The Monocled Mutineer, which the BBC have promised to show. We'll see if they do. And also the film Oh What a Lovely War 2.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
So it's the 20th anniversary this week of the death of the Texas-born comedian Bill Hicks. We can't go this week without hearing a little bit from him. And this is one of those extremely politically charged bits of humour that meant that he may have been a bit of a danger to the US establishment.
Kennedy. I love talking about the Kennedy assassination, because to me it's a great example of a totalitarian government's ability to manage information and thus keep us in the dark any way they do. Oh, sorry, wrong meeting. That's the meeting we're having tomorrow at the docks. I love talking about Kennedy. I was just down in Dallas, Texas. You know, you can go down there and to Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated, and you can actually go to the sixth floor of the School Book Depository. It's a museum called the Assassination Museum. I think named that after the assassination. I can't be too sure of the chronology here, but anyway, they have the window set up to look exactly like it did on that day, and it's really accurate, you know, because Oswald's not in it. Yeah, so. Painstaking accuracy, you know. It's true. It's called a sniper's nest. It's glassed in. It's got the boxes sitting there, and you can't actually get to the window itself. And the reason they did that, of course, they didn't want thousands of American tourists getting there each year going, "No way! I can't even see the road! They're lying to us! Where are they? There's no way! Not unless Oswald was hanging by his toes upside down from the ledge. Either that or some pigeons grabbed onto him, flew him over the motorcade. Surely someone would have seen that. You know, there was rumors of anti-Castro pigeons seen drinking in bars. Someone overheard them saying, coo, coo, coo." Unbelievable. And you know what's wild is people's attitudes in the States about it. Talking about Kennedy, people come up to me, "Bill, quit talking about Kennedy, man. Let it go. It's a long time ago. Just forget about it." I'm like, "All right, then don't bring up Jesus to me." Well, as long as we're talking shelf life here. "Bill, you know, Jesus died for you." "Yeah, it was a long time ago. Forget about it. How about this? Get Pilate to release the files. Quit washing your hands, Pilate, and release the goddamn files. Who else was on that grassy Golgotha that day?" "Bill, it was just, you know, taking over of democracy by totalitarian government. Let it go." Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back into the left. Back into the left. Which, by the way, that action you see Kennedy's head do in the Zapruder film? Caused by a bullet. Coming from up there. Yeah. I know it looks to the layman or someone who might dabble in physics. This action here would have been caused by a bullet coming from, well, up here. Did you see that? Did everyone see that? Yeah, but no. What happened was Oswald's gun went off, causing an echo to echo through the buildings of Dealey Plaza. And the echo went by the limo on the left, up into the grassy knoll, hitting some leaves, causing dust to fly out, which 56 witnesses testified was a gunshot, because immediately Kennedy's head went over. But the reason his head went over is because the echo went by the motorcade on the left, and he went, "What was that?" So there. We have figured it out. Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it all transpired. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here is American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a woman who murdered 3 men in 10 days and tried to kill 2 more is to spend the rest of her life behind bars. A judge at the Old Bailey said Joanne Dennehy, who dumped her victims' bodies in ditches in Cambridgeshire, was cruel, calculating and manipulative. Criminal psychologist David Wilson says the 31-year-old